25th of December, the first day to noticeably lengthen after the day of the winter solstice, the 21st of December. At the midnight hour on the first minutes of the 25th of December, the birthday of the sun was commemorated. The sun was then in the zodiacal sign of Capricorn, then known as the stable of Augeas, so the infant sun god was said to have been born in a stable. Brightly shining on the meridian was Sirius, the star from the east, while rising in the east was Virgo, the virgin, with the horizon passing through the center of the constellation. To the right of Sirius was the constellation Orion, the great hunter, with three stars in his belt. These stars in a straight line point at Sirius and were anciently known as the Three Kings. We have met them in the Gospels as the three magi, or wise men from the east. In the zodiac of Dendera, the constellation of Virgo was pictured as a woman with a spike of corn in one hand, and on the adjacent margin, the virgin was denoted by a figure of Isis with Horus in her arms. If anyone doubts the relevance of this to the Christian cult, then ponder the words of Edward Carpenter. But it is well known as a matter of history that the worship of Isis and Horus descended in the early Christian centuries to Alexandria, where it took the form of the worship of the Virgin Mary and the infant Savior, and so passed into the European ceremonial. We have therefore the Virgin Mary connected by linear succession and descent with that remote zodiacal cluster in the sky. A curious confirmation of the same astronomical connection is afforded by the Roman Catholic calendar. For if this be consulted, it will be found that the festival of the Assumption of the Virgin is placed on the 15th August, while the festival of the birth of the Virgin is dated the 8th September. At the present day, the zodiacal signs, owing to precession, have shifted some distance from the constellations of the same name. But at the time when the zodiac was constituted and these names were given, the first date obviously would signalize the actual disappearance of the cluster Virgo in the sun's rays, that is, the Assumption of the Virgin into the glory of God, while the second date would signalize the reappearance of the constellation, or the birth of the Virgin. At the winter solstice, the sun was at the lowest point of the celestial sphere, at its southern limits. Then it began to move northward along the ecliptic, passing over the celestial equator at the vernal equinox, Easter. The crossing of the sun from the south to the north side of the equator was the origin of the festival of the Passover. When the sun passed over the celestial equator 3,000 years ago, it was situated in Aries, the lamb, or ram, so the lamb became the symbol of the sun god. This suggests the origin of the paschal lamb, widely known as a symbol of the crucified Christ. Several of the sacrificed saviors were said to have been crucified in the heavens. This solar crucifixion may be explained as follows. For in an astronomical chart, the sun is apparently crucified upon the intersecting lines of the equator and the ecliptic at the moment of his descent into the lower hemisphere, the hemisphere of darkness and death, and so again at the moment of his resurrection into the hemisphere of light and life, while the period of transit is 3 days. At the time when the myth of the death of the sun god originated, the sun, being in the constellation Aries at the spring equinox, was identified with the ram. That is the lamb which has been slain from the foundation of the world. The custom of dressing the paschal lamb in the shape of a cross is referable to the same myth. In the vast corpus of world mythology, we have vegetation gods, tree gods, star gods, moon gods, sun gods, etc. But Osiris of Egypt seems to have been all of these blended into one. In the temple of Isis at Philae was an engraving of the body of Osiris with stalks of corn growing out of it, and sometimes this god was called the crop or harvest, so he was symbolic of the corn which annually died and came to life again. Besides being a corn spirit, Osiris was also a tree god. His worshippers chopped down a pine tree and hollowed out the center. An image of Osiris was fashioned from the excavated wood and buried like a corpse in the hollow of a tree. The image was kept for a year and then burned in the hall of Osiris at Dendera. There is a picture of a coffin enclosed within the bark of a tree, and in the coffin is the hawk-headed mummy of the god. Osiris was, in addition, a god of fertility, for phallic images of him were shown in the temples and carried in processions. To cite Fraser, as a god of vegetation, Osiris was naturally conceived as a god of creative energy in general, since men at a certain stage of evolution failed to distinguish between the reproductive powers of animals and of plants. At his festival, women used to go about the villages singing songs in his praise and carrying obscene images of him, which they set in motion by means of strings. The custom was probably a charm to ensure the growth of crops. Osiris, in one aspect, was a god of the dead. Among his titles were Ruler of the Dead, Lord of the Underworld, and Lord of Eternity. On the monument, he occupies the judgment seat and holds the staff of authority and the cross of life. On his breast, a St. Andrew's cross may be seen, and his throne is covered with a pattern of squares in two colors, like a chessboard, representing the good and evil which he was required to judge. That Osiris shone as a moon god, we are not permitted to doubt. Osiris is credited with ruling over Egypt for 28 years. This is symbolic of the 28 days of the lunar month. The rending of the corpse of Osiris into 14 parts by Set and his fellow conspirators refers to the waning of the moon, which was imagined to lose a part of itself on each of the 14 days of the second half of the lunar month. The mythical account tells of Set's discovery of the body of Osiris at the time of the full moon, so the dismemberment took place during the waning of the moon. An explanation of this was given by Gerald Massey. Osiris, as light-giver in the moon, was torn in 14 pieces during the latter half of the lunation by the evil Sut, the opposing power of darkness. He was put together again and reconstituted by his son, beloved Horus, the young solar god. This representation could not have been made until it was known that the lunar light was replenished monthly from the solar source. Then Horus, as the sun god and the vanquisher of Sut, the power of darkness, could be called the reconstitutor of Osiris in the moon. The spring season in Egypt was heralded by the new moon of the month of Phamenoth, and at this time in the temples, the ceremony of the entry of Osiris into the moon was celebrated. At the rite of the burial of Osiris, his worshippers built a crescent-shaped chest, because the moon approaching the sun becomes crescent-shaped and then vanishes. On the monuments, Osiris is sometimes seen as a human-headed mummy, holding the emblems of power and wearing on his head the image of a full moon within a crescent. The role of Osiris as a sun god is beyond all disputes among the knowledgeable. The only authority that dogmatically denied this was Sir J.G. Fraser, who argued that since Osiris was a god of vegetation, then he could not have been a sun god. This brought a sharp retort from the Right Honorable John M. Robertson. Rightly intent on establishing a hitherto ill-developed principle of the mythological interpretation, the cult of the vegetation spirit, Dr. Fraser had unduly ignored the conjunction seen deductively to be inevitable and inductively to be normal between the concept of the vegetation god and that of others, in particular the sun god. He becomes for once vigorously polemical in his attack on the thesis that Osiris was a sun god, as if that were excluded once for all by proving him a vegetation god. The answer is that he was both, and that such a synthesis was inevitable. Dionysus and Adonis, Dr. Fraser shows, are vegetation gods, yet they too are both born on December 25th, as was the babe sun god Horus, who, however, was exhibited as rising from a lotus plant. Now, why should the vegetation god be born at the winter solstice, save as having been identified with the sun god? The esoteric religious rites of the ancient Egyptians were known as the mysteries. There were two sets of mysteries. Osiris was the god of the greater mysteries, and Isis was worshipped in the lesser mysteries. The mysteries were based on dramatic performances representing the death of Osiris, the sun god, and the search for his body by Isis, the moon goddess. Many ancient nations celebrated mysteries, but those of Egypt were the earliest. In the words of Brown, the mysteries of all the other nations were quite similar to those of Egypt, and were no doubt derived from them. The sacerdotal caste of ancient Egypt were an admirable group of men, possessed of keen intellect, profound knowledge, and high character. The mystery schools of Egypt were the world's earliest universities. The wise men of ancient Greece went to Egypt for their higher education. Among these men were Plato, Thales, Eudoxus, and Pythagoras. Plato studied in the Nile Valley for 13 years. The metaphysical doctrines, now called Platonic, were first taught in the sanctuaries of Thebes, Memphis, and Heliopolis, long before Plato was born. The literature of the Egyptian mysteries is not extensive, but there are some surviving fragments which we can study with profit. Iamblichus, a Greek philosopher of the 4th century, wrote a learned treatise on the mysteries of the Egyptians, in which he described some of the tests faced by candidates for membership in that secret order. When a postulant applied for admission to the Sacred Brotherhood, he was greeted by two thesmothetes, guardians of the rites. The ceremony took place at night, and the applicant, with bandaged eyes, was led to the entrance of the temple. After entering the sacred precincts, the postulant was led down a spiral staircase of 22 steps, and there a door was opened which gave access to a circular room. The candidate was then told that he was on the brink of a precipice. "This abyss," said the guide, "surrounds the Temple of the Mysteries and protects it against the temerity and curiosity of the profane. We have arrived a little too soon. Our brethren have not lowered the drawbridge by which the initiates communicate with the sacred place. Let us wait for their arrival. But if you value your life, do not move. Cross your hands on your breast, and do not take off the bandage until the signal is given." The postulate, of course, obeyed, and the thesmothetes then took from an altar robes of linen, a gold and silver belt, and two masks, one of a lion's head, the other that of a bull. The robes were emblems of moral purity. The gold belt was consecrated to the sun, the silver one to the moon. The lion's head symbolized the zodiacal sign Leo, the throne of the genius of the sun. The bull's head symbolized the sign of Taurus, the throne of the genius of the moon. After the thesmothetes donned their masks, a trap door opened in the floor with a clanging sound, and from this opening a mechanical monster arose, brandishing a scythe, and loudly cried, "Woe to him who comes to disturb the peace of the dead!" At this point, the eyes of the postulant were unbandaged, and he found himself facing the monster. The specter with the scythe brushed his head 7 times with that implement, then vanished as the trapdoor closed with a bang. If the postulant had not by this time collapsed from fright, the thesmothetes then removed their beast-like masks and commended him for his courage, saying, "You felt the chill of murderous steel and you did not recoil. You looked at the horror of horrors and your eyes defied it. Well done. But among us there is a virtue higher than manly courage, and that is the voluntary humility which triumphs over the vanity of pride. Are you capable of such a victory over yourself?" After giving assent, the candidate faced another test. "Very well," he was told. "Will you crawl flat on the ground, right to the innermost sanctuary, where our brethren await you, to give you knowledge and power in exchange for humility?" The postulant again signified assent, and was given the following command. "Then take this lamp. It is the image of God's face when we walk hidden from the sight of men. Go without fear. You have only yourself to be afraid of in the test of solitude." One of the guides next touched a hidden spring in the wall, which caused an iron plaque to slide sideways, revealing a long and narrow tunnel. Then the candidate was told, "Let this path be for you the image of the tomb, in which all men find their rest in the evening of life, yet only to awake freed from the darkness of material things in the eternal dawn of life in the spirit. You have vanquished the specter of death. Go triumph over the horrors of the tomb." On entering the tunnel, the admitting door clanged to a close behind the pilgrim, and a voice in the distance said, "Here perish all fools who covet knowledge and power." This message was transmitted acoustically, fading away through 7 distinctly spaced echoes. Finally, the struggling postulant emerged from the tunnel. Above him was a rising roof, In front of him, a downward sloping path, and at last a dark pit was reached, on the brink of which was an iron ladder descending into the depths. After climbing down 78 rungs of the ladder to its termination, the potential initiate could see no bottom to the pit, so then he climbed back upwards and, with lamp in hand, found a crevice and, passing into it, discovered a spiral stairway. After climbing 22 steps up the stairs, the postulant saw through a bronze grating a long gallery flanked by two rows of sculptured sphinxes, 24 in number, 12 on each side. Between the statues, the walls were covered with frescoes showing mysterious personages and symbols. There were altogether 22 pictures, 11 on each side, facing each other, and the gallery was illuminated by lamps situated on 11 bronze tripods with wicks fueled by aromatic oils. At this point, a magus, known as a pastophore, guardian of the sacred symbols, opened the grating to the entrance of the gallery and said to the awaiting postulant, "Son of Earth, be welcome. You have escaped the pit by discovering the path of wisdom. Few aspirants to the mysteries have triumphed over this test. The others have all perished. Since the great Isis is your protector, she will lead you, I hope, safe and sound to the sanctuary, where virtue receives its crown. I must not hide from you that other perils lie in store, but I am allowed to encourage you by explaining these symbols, the understanding of which creates for the heart of man an invincible armor. Come with me and contemplate these sacred images. Listen carefully to my words, and if you can mind them in your memory, the kings of the world will be less powerful than you when you return to Earth." The pastophore pointed out the paintings to the postulant one at a time, but before going into details, explained the general meaning of the 22 arcana, as these frescoes were called, as follows. "The science of will, the principle of all wisdom and source of all power, is contained in 22 arcana, or symbolic hieroglyphs, each of whose attributes conceals a certain meaning, and which, taken as a whole, compose an absolute doctrine, memorized by its correspondence with letters of the sacred language and with the numbers that are connected with these letters. Each letter and each number contemplated by the eye or uttered by the mouth expresses a reality of the divine world, the intellectual world, and the physical world. Each arcanum, made visible or tangible by one of these paintings, is a formula of a law of human activity in its relations with spiritual and material forces, whose combination produces the phenomena of life. The 22 arcana are described here. Arcanum 1, letter A, number 1. This fresco featured the picture of the magus, or the wise man. He wore a fine robe, and his belt was made in the form of a serpent biting its own tail, a symbol of eternity. He wore a golden headdress, symbolic of the light of the sun. In his right hand was a scepter of gold, the image of command, raised heavenward as a gesture of aspiration toward knowledge, wisdom, and power. The index finger of the left hand pointed to the ground, signifying that the mission of the perfect man was to reign over the material world. Before the magus, on a square stone, were depicted a goblet, a sword, and a gold coin embellished with a cross. The goblet stood for the mixture of passion producing happiness or misery. The sword represented the strivings leading to the conquest of obstacles. The gold coin symbolized worthwhile achievements, and the cross engraved on the coin was emblematic of the power to be attained in the world of the future. Arcanum 2, letter B, number 2. Here was the picture of a woman seated on the threshold of a temple of Isis, and on her head was a crown topped by a crescent moon. Her face was veiled, a solar cross on her breast, and in her lap an open book, half covered by a cloak. The seated woman symbolized occult science waiting for the initiate on the threshold of the temple of Isis. The solar cross stood for matter energized by spirit. The veil was an emblem of truth, hiding itself from profane curiosity, and the half-hidden book meant that the mysteries were revealed only to the wise man who wrapped himself in the cloak of silent meditation. Arcanum 3, Letter C, Number 3. The feature here was a woman seated at the center of a blazing sun, crowned by 12 stars, and with her feet resting on the moon. The woman was the symbol of Mother Nature. The sun represented creative strength. The 12 stars stood for the 12 signs of the zodiac, and the moon signified matter and its domination by spirit. Arcanum 4, Letter D, Number 4. This painting was that of a man seated on a square stone holding a scepter, while on his head was a helmet topped by a crown. The stone cube stood for conquered matter. The scepter was a symbol of the goddess Isis, and the crowned helmet signified strength, conquering power. Arcanum 5, Letter E, Number 5. This fresco featured the Hierophant, master of the sacred mysteries, and represented the genius of good intentions and the spirit of conscience. Arcanum 6, Letters U, V, Number 6. Here was shown a man standing at a crossroads flanked by two women, each woman with a hand on the man's shoulder and with each of the other hands pointing to one of two roads. The woman on the right, with a golden headdress, represented virtue. The one on the left, crowned with vine leaves, depicted vice. Arcanum 7, Letter Z, Number 7. This picture was that of a conqueror riding in a chariot, with a sword in one hand and a scepter in the other. The sword was a sign of victory. The scepter, embellished with a triangle, symbolized spirit. A square, standing for matter, and a circle, signifying eternity, altogether represented the dominance of mind over matter. Arcanum 8, Letter H, Number 8. This arcanum showed a woman on a throne, holding in one hand an upward-pointing sword, and with the other, a pair of scales, symbolic of justice opposing evil with a sword, and weighing the deeds of mankind in a balance. Arcanum 9, Letters T, H, Number 9. This fresco was that of an old man walking and leaning on a stick, and holding in front of himself a lantern, half hidden by a cloak. The old man represented experience acquired in the labors of life. The light of the lantern was the mind, which illuminated past, present, and future. The concealing cloak was discretion, and the stick symbolized prudence. Arcanum 10, Letters I, J, Y, Number 10. A wheel was here shown, suspended on its axle between two columns. This was the wheel of fate. On the right, Hermanubis, the good spirit, was shown climbing to the top of the wheel. On the left, Set, the evil spirit, was depicted as being cast down. A sphinx balanced on top of the wheel held a sword in his leonine paws, which represented destiny, ready to strike to right or left. The turning wheel caused the humble to rise and the mighty to be cast down. Arcanum 11, Letters C, K, Number 20. Here was pictured the image of a maiden closing the jaws of a lion with her bare hands, and this was symbolic of the strength created by self-confidence. Arcanum 12, Letter L, Number 30. This fresco showed a man hanging by one foot from a gallows, the sign of a violent death brought on by a tragic accident. Arcanum 13, Letter M, Number 40. In a meadow was shown a skeleton cutting off the heads of men, while on the ground the hands and feet of men sprouted up. This signified the rebirth of all forms of being in the realm of time. Arcanum 14, Letter N, Number 50. Here we have the spirit of the sun holding two urns and pouring from one into the other the sap of life, this symbolizing the various combinations produced by nature. Arcanum 15, Letter X, Number 60. This scene featured Set, the spirit of evil, rising out of a flaming abyss and holding a torch above two men chained at his feet. This was the symbol of fatality, which overwhelmed great or small, strong or weak. Arcanum 16, letter O, number 70. A tower is shown being struck by lightning, and a crowned and an uncrowned man being cast down from its summit, this being symbolic of material forces which crush both the great and the small alike. Arcanum 17, letters F, P, number 80. A picture of a blazing star with eight rays surrounded by seven other stars. This was the Star of Destiny. The seven other stars represented the sun, the moon, and the five planets visible to the naked eye. Arcanum 18, letters T, S, number 90. Here we see a tower in the midst of a barren landscape, with a path on each side and illuminated by a half-clouded moon at twilight. This depicted a false security which did not see hidden perils. Arcanum 19, letter Q, number 100. A radiant sun was shown shining on two small children holding hands in the midst of a circle of flowers, and this symbolized the happiness of a simple life. Arcanum 20, letter R, number 200. This picture was of a spirit blowing a trumpet over a half-open tomb from which a man, woman, and child were rising. This was a sign of change, of the end of all things, both good and evil. Arcanum 21, letter S, number 300. A picture of a blind man with a bulging wallet about to collide with a broken obelisk on which was a crocodile with open jaws. The blind man represented a slave of material things, and his wallet was filled with errors and faults. The obelisk represented the ruin of his works, and the crocodile was an emblem of fate. Arcanum 22, letter T, number 400. Here was a star surrounded by a garland of roses arranged to form a circle. At the four quarters of the circle were, respectively, the heads of a man, a bull, a lion, and an eagle. These symbols corresponded to the four quarter signs of the zodiac: Aquarius, Taurus, Leo, and Scorpio. At the end of the gallery of the arcana, the pastophore opened a door and showed the postulant a long, narrow vault, at the end of which was a blazing furnace, then said to him, "Son of Earth, death itself frightens the imperfect only. If you are afraid, what are you doing here? Look at me. Once I too passed through those flames as if they were a garden of roses." The postulant then walked toward the flames and found them to be an optical illusion produced by lights. He then walked on and came to a pool, and on looking back saw flaming oil falling from a hole in the ceiling. So he was between the ordeals of fire and water and proceeded to walk into the pool. At the middle of the pool, the water was neck high, but he kept going, and the slope of the pool began to rise as he walked on to the other side of the water. There, after ascending a flight of steps, he reached a platform surrounded on three sides by a lofty arcade. Locating a door on a wall and opening aforesaid door, a voice was heard saying, "If you stop, you will perish. Behind you is death. Before you, salvation." On the door was a ring, which, when grasped by the postulant, caused the floor to collapse under him, leaving him hanging over a pit. As he held on to the ring, the floor came back under his feet, and the door opened. Inside the door, he was met by a delegation of 12 Neocors, guardians of the sanctuary. The eyes of the postulant were then bandaged, and he was led through another tunnel. Afterwards, the party passed through several secret doors by giving passwords and signs of recognition. In an underground vault, the College of the Magi awaited the arrival of the new applicant. On the platform was the Hierophant, clad in a purple robe. On his head was a golden circlet decorated with the images of 7 stars, and this dignitary sat on a silver throne. The other magi, wearing albs and plain gold circlets on their heads, were seated in a triple semicircle around the Hierophant, but on a lower level. Escorted by the 12 Neocors, the postulant was led into the assemblage of the magi. The new candidate was greeted by the Hierophant, who requested him to make a solemn vow never to reveal anything seen or heard in the initiation ceremonies. The postulant then knelt at the altar and gave the necessary oath. He was then informed by the Hierophant that, "From this hour forward, you are counted among the number of the disciples of wisdom, and you will bear among us the title of zealot, until by some great act of obedience and self-abnegation, you have deserved to be raised to a higher rank." The new initiate was then required to make a second oath, swearing obedience to the Hierophant, which he did. After this, the bandage was removed, and the neophyte saw all the magi pointing swords at his breast. Again the Hierophant spoke, "These swords symbolize human justice, but this often is fallible or slow, and the fear it inspires does not stop man's audacity. We want heaven itself to guarantee the faith of the new initiates. You have sworn me absolute obedience. You must test it by an ordeal from which only the all-powerful can save you, if he judge you worthy of life." The swords were then lowered. Then 2 Neocors approached, each carrying a goblet. "You see these goblets," declared the Hierophant. "The contents of one is harmless. In the other is a violent poison. I command you to seize without reflection one of them and empty it in a single draft." This order was obeyed by the candidate, who was relieved to find no harmful results ensuing. He was then informed that he was in no danger, since the contents of both goblets were harmless. After passing other tests successfully, the postulant was finally accepted into membership in the Mysteries. Then he was permitted to join the Magi in a religious banquet. After becoming a zealot, if the new initiate sought promotion to a higher rank, he had to study 12 more years with the Magi. The next grade, the second, was that of the Theoricus. The third grade bore the name Practicus. A fourth grade initiate was called a philosopher. The fifth grade title was Minor Adept. The sixth grade, Major Adept. The seventh, Franchised Adept. And the eighth, Master of the Temple. Finally, the ninth grade initiate was called Magus of the Rose Cross. Only the magi of the ninth degree were permitted to govern the state. The Savior God religions, Christianity included, are based on the worship of nature. Nature may be defined as the material universe and the forces at work in the cosmos, which operate independently of man. Among the many varieties of natural religion were the worship of the earth, of trees and other plants, of volcanoes, mountains, water and wind, of animals, of stars, planets, the moon, the sun, the sky, etc. This nature worship was based on the doctrine of animism, a belief that material objects are inhabited by indwelling spiritual forces. This doctrine evolved through 3 stages. 1, the conception of human souls or spirits. 2, a belief in non-human spirits regarded as the cause of natural events. 3, the belief in gods, one or many. The earliest important religious cult was the worship of the earth in the image of the Great Mother. Mother Earth was the first great terrestrial deity. Among other terrestrial cults were the worship of plants and animals. At a later date, sky worship developed, and Father Sky became the consort of Mother Earth. The general worship of the sky evolved in due time into the following celestial cults. 1, star and planet worship. 2, moon worship. 3, sun worship. Later on in time, these various cults intermixed and blended and became quite complex. In the mythology of ancient Egypt, the various gods were closely associated with the calendar. Stars were used to measure time in Egypt and Western Asia as early as 14,500 BC. Later on, a lunar calendar was developed, and finally, a solar calendar. When you combine the stars, the moon, the planets, and the sun in an endeavor to tell time accurately, the understanding of the complete system requires considerable study. For instance, in the study of the astral theology of ancient Egypt, as an eminent authority pointed out, the casual reader would be at a loss to know which was the supreme god of the Egyptians, whether Ra, Osiris, or Horus. Ra is the sun god, the god of the solar year. Osiris is the god of the lunisolar year of 364 days, and merges in Ra when the year is reconstituted to be of proper length. And Horus represents the added part, and thus the accurate year. Temples were erected in Upper Egypt around 6400 BC, oriented to the star Canopus, which symbolized Khonsu, an early southern star god. The ancient Egyptians worshipped two sets of polar gods, both eight in number, and four compass gods. The eight polar gods of the north were ultimately combined with the four compass gods to make up the 12 zodiacal gods. There were two types of zodiac, lunar and solar. The lunar zodiac, with its 27 or 28 lunar mansions, was much earlier than the solar zodiac, with its 12 signs. Since civilization in Africa originated south of the equator, the earliest Nilotic polar gods were those relating to the South Pole. Khnumu was the god of the South Pole. He was the creator of the universe and the maker of man. He was called the Lord of Nubia and was depicted as ram-headed. In his creative work, he was assisted by seven architects. Ptah was the god of the North Pole. He was also a creator god and was assisted by his seven sons. The seven architects of Khnumu and the seven sons of Ptah symbolized the seven positions of the changing pole stars due to the precession of the equinoxes. There were, as a result, a total of eight gods at each pole, both north and south. The original zodiac had only four constellations situated at the four corners of the sky, the position of the two equinoxes and the two solstices. The other eight were later fitted in between the original four. In ancient Egypt, the names, symbols, directions, colors, and seasons were as follows. Amset was symbolized by a man. Its direction was north, its color red, and its season winter. Tuamutef was symbolized by a jackal. Its direction was east, its color white, and its season spring. Gebsenuf was symbolized by a hawk. Its direction was west, its color white, and its season autumn. Hapi was symbolized by an ape. Its direction was south, its color green, and its season summer. These compass gods, when later incorporated into the zodiac as standardized by the Greeks, were in respect to names, symbols, locations, and directions, as here follows. Aquarius was symbolized by a waterman. Its location was the winter solstice, and its direction was north. Taurus was symbolized by a bull. Its location was the vernal equinox, and its direction east. Scorpio was symbolized by a scorpion. Its location was the autumnal equinox and its direction west. Leo was symbolized by a lion. Its location was the summer solstice and its direction south. The original four zodiacal constellations and their principal stars were Leo, whose star was Regulus, Scorpio, whose star was Antares, Aquarius, whose star was Fomalhaut, and Taurus, whose star was Aldebaran. Among the ancient Hebrews, these symbols with their corresponding directions and seasons were man, direction north, season winter, ox, direction east, season spring, eagle, direction west, season autumn, lion, direction south, season summer. The early Christians adopted these symbols and related them to the four evangelists as follows. Matthew's symbol was a man, his direction north, his season winter. Luke's symbol was an ox, his direction east, his season spring. John's symbol was an eagle, his direction west, his season autumn. Mark's symbol was a lion, his direction south, his season summer. A picture of the sculptured relief on Chartres Cathedral is shown on page 20 of Carl G. Jung's Man and His Symbols, in which the four evangelists are depicted as follows. Mark as a lion, Luke as an ox, John as an eagle, and Matthew as a man. On page 21 of the same book, there is a picture of the four sons of Horus of ancient Egypt. These are the four compass gods previously mentioned, and they were imagined as an ape, man, jackal, and hawk. In both instances, we have a group composed of three animals and one man. This symbolism of the four quarters was known in both the Old and New Worlds in very remote ages. Among the Chaldeans of Western Asia, these symbols were familiar, and their names, symbols, directions, and seasons were Ustur, who was symbolized by a man with a direction of north and a season of winter, Kirub, who was symbolized by a bull with a direction of east and a season of spring, Natting, who was symbolized by an eagle with a direction of west and a season of autumn, Nurgle, who was symbolized by a lion with a direction of south and a season of summer. In ancient China, the compass gods were 1. The black warrior of the north, 2. The green dragon of the east, 3. The white tiger of the west, and 4. The red bird of the south. In ancient America, this same complex prevailed among the Mayans and the Aztecs. The Mayan god Muluk had a direction of north and the color white. The god Khan had a direction of east and the color red. The god Ix had a direction of west and the color black. The god Kauak had a direction of south and the color yellow. The Aztec god Tecpatl had a direction of north and the color white. The god Akatl had a direction of east and the color red. The god Kali had a direction of west and the color black. The god Tochtli had a direction of south and the color yellow. This symbolism of the lords of the four quarters still survives in West Africa. In the words of Dr. Churchward, the people of Bivoli, Bini, and Yoruba, West Africa, have the same under the names of 1. Ibara, 2. Edi, 3. Oyekun, and 4. Osbe, and built these names with Ifi, the son of God, that is, Horus, into the walls of their houses. The anthropologist Lord Reglan supplements the proceeding with the following remarks. Turning to Africa, we are told that the Malagasy of Madagascar regard the cardinal points of the compass as four deities. On the mainland, these beliefs seem to be confined to West Africa. Of the Akoi of Nigeria, recent investigation has shown that the religious and ceremonial use of the number four has its origins in the recognition of four quarter gods, and that a similar complex is found among the Igbo and Yoruba. And among the Songhai and Mande, the world is considered to be divided into four quarters. The Igbo of Nigeria say that the earth was divided into four quarters by the crossing paths of the sun and the moon. Attentive readers of the Christian Bible will find many incidents of astral symbolism recorded in that work. In the Apocalypse, we read about the four beasts and the four horsemen. The beasts were the zodiacal constellations, and the horsemen were the planets. In Revelation 4:7, we read, "The first beast was like a lion, and the second beast like a calf, and the third beast had a face as a man, and the fourth beast was like a flying eagle." These celestial animals were the quarter constellations of the zodiac of 5,000 years ago. This fact was noticed and explained by Higgins, to wit, "The signs of the zodiac, with the exception of the scorpion, which was exchanged by Dan for the eagle, were carried by the different tribes of the Israelites on their standards, and Taurus, Leo, Aquarius, and Scorpio, or the eagle, the four signs of Reuben, Judah, Ephraim, and Dan, were placed at the four corners, the four cardinal points of their encampment, evidently in allusion to the cardinal points of the sphere, the equinoxes and solstices, when the equinox was in Taurus. As to the four horsemen and their steeds, 1. The first horseman was a conqueror armed with a bow, wearing a crown, and riding a white horse. This was the planet Venus. 2. The second horse was red, ridden by a warrior with a sword. This was the planet Mars. 3. The third horse was black, with the rider holding aloft a pair of balances. This was the planet Saturn. 4. The fourth horse was of pale green or blue-green color, and his rider was Death. This was the planet Mercury. There has been much speculation on the origin of the zodiac. One of the best was penned by George St. Clair. About 6,000 years ago, the spring sun would be entering Taurus, and the four quarter signs would be the bull, the lion, the scorpion, and the waterman, though some of these signs might be otherwise named. In memory of that early arrangement, which in many ways left its mark, devices on rings were, for example, a scorpion, a lion, a hawk, and an acinocephalous ape. From the four quarters we pass to the 12 signs. Between each two quarter signs, two other signs were inserted. The planisphere of the Temple of Dendera shows four gods supporting the heavens at the four quarter points, corresponding to the bull, the lion, the scorpion, and the waterman, and shows eight other divinities in pairs, one on either side of each pillar, making up the 12. In the biblical book of Genesis, chapter 49, we may read the story of Jacob and his children, 12 sons and one daughter. A little study will show that Jacob was the sun and that his children were the 12 zodiacal constellations. Arranged in their proper order, they were Gad, Aries, Issachar, Taurus, Simeon and Levi, Gemini, Benjamin, Cancer, Judah, Leo, Dinah, Virgo, Asher, Libra, Dan, Scorpio, Joseph, Sagittarius, Naphtali, Capricorn, Reuben, Aquarius, and Zebulon, Pisces. The zodiac with which we are familiar today originated with the Greeks, but there were earlier zodiacs with different symbols going back to a remote antiquity. One of these was discussed by one of the great Egyptologists of the last century. I refer to Gerald Massey, whose six-volume study on the religion and mythology of ancient Egypt are certainly classics in their field of study. The following passage is from Massey's last and greatest work. Taking the same order in which the signs on the ecliptic are read today when Aries has become Princeps Zodiaci, we can identify at least a dozen of the deities of Egypt with the 12 signs. 1. The ram-headed Amen with the constellation Aries. 2. Osiris, the bull of eternity, with Taurus. 3. The Sut-Horus twins with the Gemini. 4. The beetle-headed Kheper Ptah with the sign of the beetle, later crab. 5. The lion-faced Atum with Leo. 6. The virgin Neith with the constellation Virgo. 7. Har-Maku of the scales with the sign of Libra. 8. Isis Serk, the scorpion goddess, with the sign of Scorpio. 9. Shu and Tefnut, figured as the archer with the sign of Sagittarius. 10. Num, the goat-headed, who presided over the abyss, with the sign of Capricornus. 11. Menat, the divine wet nurse, with the sign of Aquarius. 12. Horus of the two crocodiles, with the sign of Pisces. The role of the zodiacal symbolism in ancient mythology and religion was revealed to the modern world by a French scholar, Charles-François Dupuis, 1742-1809, who wrote a 12-volume work entitled The Origin of All Religious Worship. A one-volume abridgment, translated into English, was published in New Orleans in 1872, and extracts from this translation have recently been reprinted in The Rise of Modern Mythology by Burton Feldman and Robert D. Richardson. Count Volney was a disciple of Dupuis and popularized many of his ideas in The Ruins of Empires. I will refer to this important work again in this essay. Some of the key ideas have been concisely epitomized by Professor Richardson as follows. Dupuis traced much of Western civilization, religion, and myth to the development of the zodiac. He argued the zodiac must have arisen in North Africa, in Upper Egypt and Ethiopia, about 15,000 years ago, since the constellations and their signs were matched best at that time and place. The zodiac, Dupuy thought, was an astronomical and agricultural calendar, the first most important schematization of the astral, solar, and lunar events that interested early man, and the general source of most early stories, personifications, and myths. Early man, according to Dupuy, worshipped nature and the forces of nature. He did not worship some abstract or non-existent force behind or above nature. The theoretical position taken by Dupuy was brilliantly defended by his disciple Volney, and at a later date by Massey and Churchward. The classic statement on the origin of the zodiacal system was given by Count Volney in his celebrated Ruins of Empires, and since that work is now out of print, I reproduce the following eloquent passage. Should it be asked at what epoch this system took its birth, we shall answer on the testimony of the monuments of astronomy itself, that its principles appear with certainty to have been established about 17,000 years ago. And if it be asked to what people it is to be attributed, we shall answer that the same monuments, supported by the unanimous traditions, attribute it to the first tribes of Egypt. And when reason finds in that country all the circumstances which could lead to such a system, when it finds there a zone of sky bordering on the tropic, equally free from the rains of the equator and the fogs of the north, when it finds there a central point of the sphere of the ancients, a salubrious climate, a great but manageable river, a soil fertile without art or labor, inundated without morbid exhalations, and placed between two seas which communicate with the richest countries, it conceives that the inhabitant of the Nile, addicted to agriculture from the nature of his soil, to geometry from the annual necessity of measuring his lands, to commerce from the facility of communications, to astronomy from the state of the sky, always open to observation, must have been the first to pass from the savage to the social state, and consequently to attain the physical and moral sciences necessary to civilized life. It was, then, on the borders of the Upper Nile, among a black race of men, that was organized the complicated system of the worship of the stars, considered in relation to the productions of the earth and the labors of agriculture. And this first worship, characterized by their adoration under their own forms and natural attributes, was a simple proceeding of the human mind. As soon as this agricultural people began to observe the stars with attention, they found it necessary to individualize or group them, and to assign to each a proper name. A great difficulty must have presented itself. First, the heavenly bodies, similar in form, offered no distinguishing characteristics by which to denominate them. And secondly, the language in its infancy and poverty had no expressions for so many new and metaphysical ideas. Necessity, the usual stimulus of genius, surmounted everything. Having remarked that in the annual revolution, the renewal and periodic appearance of terrestrial productions were constantly associated with the rising and setting of certain stars and to their position as relative to the sun, the mind, by a natural operation, connected in thought these terrestrial and celestial objects, which were connected in fact, and applying to them a common sign, it gave to the stars and their groups the names of the terrestrial objects by which they answered. Thus, the Ethiopian of Thebes named stars of inundation, or Aquarius, those stars under which the Nile began to overflow, stars of the ox or bull, those under which they began to plow, stars of the lion, those under which that animal, driven from the desert by thirst, appeared on the banks of the Nile, stars of the sheaf or of the harvest virgin, those of the reaping season, stars of the lamb, stars of the two kids, those under which these precious animals were brought forth. Thus the same Ethiopian, having observed that the return of the inundation always corresponded with the rising of a beautiful star which appeared towards the source of the Nile and seemed to warn the husbandman against the coming waters, he compared this action to that of the animal which, by his barking, gives notice of danger, and he called this star the dog, the barker, Sirius. In the same manner he named the stars of the crab, those where the sun, having arrived at the tropic, retreated by a slow retrograde motion like the crab, Cancer. He named stars of the wild goat, Capricorn, those where the sun, having reached the highest point in his annuary tract, imitates the goat, which delights to climb to the summit of the rocks. He named the stars of the balance, Libra. Those were the days and nights seen being equal in equilibrium, like that instrument. And stars, Scorpion, those where certain periodical winds bring vapors, burning like the venom of the scorpion. In the same manner he called by the names of rings and serpents the figured traces of the orbits of the stars and planets, and such was the general mode of naming all the stars and even the planets, taken by groups or as individuals, according to their relations with husbandry and terrestrial objects, and according to the analogies which each nation found between them and the object of its particular soil and climate. The symbolism of the zodiac has been brilliantly displayed in the myth of Hercules, and this myth was known among other peoples, to the Sumerians, Phoenicians, and Greeks. Herodotus named Hercules as being originally one of the great gods of Egypt. There is no god named Hercules in the official pantheon of Egypt, but an ancient Greek tradition identified Hercules with Khonsu, an ancient god of Ethiopian derivation. This deity was a member of the ancient trinity of Ethiopia. 1. Amen, 2. Nut, and 3. Khonsu. According to St. Clair, they were the divinities of Thebes, and that city was hundreds of miles south of Heliopolis. They were the trinity of Ethiopia, and not of Egypt. The Hercules saga is best known in its Greek form, but it had more ancient roots in Asia and Africa. Dupuis realized that fact and discussed it with great insight. Whatever may have been the opinions about Hercules, he was surely not a petty Grecian prince, renowned for his romantic adventures, invested with all the charms of poetry, and sung from age to age by men who had succeeded the heroic ages. It is the mighty luminary which animates and fructifies the universe, the divinity of which has been honored everywhere by the erection of temples and altars, and consecrated in religious songs in all nations. From Meroe in Ethiopia and Thebes in Upper Egypt, to the British Isles and to the snows of Scythia, from ancient Taprobane and Palibothra in the Indies to Cadiz and the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, from the forests of Germany to the burning sands of Libya, wherever the blessings of the sun were experienced, there the worship of Hercules is found established. There are sung the glorious deeds of this invincible god. Many centuries before the epic which is assigned to the son of Alcmena or to the supposed hero of Tirinthia, as the time when they made him live, Egypt and Phoenicia, which surely did not borrow their gods from Greece, had erected temples to the sun under the name of Hercules, and had carried its worship to the island of Thasus and to Cadiz, where they had also consecrated a temple to the year and to the month, which divided it into 12 parts, or in other words, to 12 labors or 12 victories, which conducted Hercules to immortality. The titles of the King of Fire, of Lord of the World and of the Planets, of Nourisher of Mankind, of the God whose glowing orb revolves eternally about the earth, and who, while followed in his track by the year, the daughter of time and mother of the 12 months, draws along in regular succession the seasons which renew and reproduce themselves, are so many traits of the sun that we should recognize them, even if the poet had not given to his Hercules the name of Helios or the sun. Dupuis was of the opinion that the 12 labors of Hercules were astronomical allegories, myths of the passage of the sun through the 12 signs of the zodiac, and that the story of Jesus Christ in the Bible was equally mythological, since both Jesus and Hercules were sun gods, and that neither were historical characters. This theory of the non-historicity of Jesus Christ has been ably defended by Count Volney, Lord Bolingbroke, Reverend Robert Taylor, Gerald Massey, Dr. Albert Churchward, Dr. Alvin Boyd Kuhn, John M. Robertson, G.R.S. Mead, and several other scholars equally eminent. In the myth of Hercules, the sun, of which Hercules was the personification, began his zodiacal trip in the constellation Leo. So the first labor of Hercules was the slaying of the Nemean lion. After killing the lion, the hero flayed the beast and used its skin thereafter as a shield. The leonine skin may be compared to the tawny clouds trailed by the sun in fighting his way through atmospheric vapors, which are eventually conquered. When the sun entered Virgo, the constellation of Hydra was setting, and thus the second labor of Hercules was to kill the Lernaean Hydra. The monster had several heads, one being immortal, and as he raised them to attack Hercules, the hero burned off the mortal heads and buried the immortal one under a stone. The esoteric meaning of this has been explained by Alcott as follows. As the beast was possessed by many heads, so the storm wind must continually supply new clouds to vanquish the sun. But the lighter vapor and mist, the immortal head, is only conquered for a time. The sun easily burns up the heavy clouds, the mortal heads, but only hides temporarily the immortal heads, which rises again and again to daunt him. In the fight, Hercules was attended by his friend Iolaus. This name recalls Ioli, signifying the violet-tinted clouds, the attendants of the sun in its serene moments. The sun entered Libra at the commencement of autumn, at the time when the constellation of the Centaur rose above the horizon. So Hercules, in his third labor, was entertained by a centaur, and soon afterwards he slew a group of centaurs in a fight over a cask of wine. When the sun was in Libra, a star group called the Boar appeared in the evening sky. So after killing the centaurs, Hercules met the Erymanthian Boar and engaged him in mortal combat. As the sun moved into Scorpio, Cassiopeia, more anciently known as the stag, rose into view. And the fourth labor of Hercules was the capture of a stag with golden horns and brazen feet. As the sun passed into Sagittarius, three constellations named after birds followed, and these were the vulture, the swan, and the eagle. In his fifth labor, Hercules killed three birds with arrows. The constellation Capricorn was also called the stable of Augeas, and the sixth labor of Hercules was the cleaning out of the Augean stable. While the sun was in Aquarius, the lyre, or celestial vulture, proceeded to set. Prometheus at the time was also setting, while the bull of Europa was on the meridian. In his seventh labor, Hercules slew the vulture which had preyed on the liver of Prometheus and captured a wild bull engaged in laying waste the island of Crete. While the sun was going through Pisces, Pegasus, the celestial horse, rose in the east. So in the eighth labor, Hercules absconded with the horses of Diomede.